ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் ஹவு டு சீ காட் எவ்ரிவேர், பாசிட்டிவ் ஆட்டிடியூட்ஸ் அண்ட் ஷிவாஸ் ஃபைவ் ஆக்ஷன்ஸ், பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. Thank you. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
We have a very special group visit us recently. What's Billy's last name? Topatate. Billy, that's why I have trouble with it. Billy Topatate. Some of you know her. She brings a group here every year. It's a metaphysical group from, where is it, Michigan or? Chicago. Metaphysical group from Chicago, and they come, and she, some of them have been coming now for 2 or 3 years, and you can tell they came because there's offerings all over the place. You know, she teaches them to give, bring flowers for the deities, bring flowers for this, bring dakshina for the monks and so forth. So we're overwhelmed with flowers in the temple and special gifts and dakshina and everything, and thank you notes afterwards. Even afterwards, she has them, she encourages them, not all of them do it, of course, but to write a note of thank you for the talk. How many times do you give a talk and afterwards get 5 or 10 notes of thank you for your wonderful talk? So, and San Swami says the puja had a very nice vibration that day, which shows a kind of drawing on the inner world, really wanting to get blessed and had been nicely prepared for the experience. You know, that's what we hope for as a nice model for other groups in the future, that a teacher can prepare the members of his or her group in such a nice way that they come and really get a lot out of their experience and fit in so beautifully. So I gave a short talk. I was trying to keep it simple, Swami. KISS principle, keep it simple, Swami. Variation on the KISS principle. And trying to talk about Hinduism in a simple way, you know, because the group doesn't have a lot of background in terms of Sanskrit words or concepts, but, you know, their heart is right there, and they have a certain grasp of metaphysical principles. So they have a good feeling for Hinduism without the details of the terminology, so I didn't want to burden them with a lot of Sanskrit words or too many different concepts. So, of course, the challenge, as any teacher knows, is to say something simply and succinctly. You know, it's easy to ramble on forever and easy to explain things with complex words, but to say it in a short, concise statement that can be understood by people without a lot of background, that's the challenge. So I went through a few different concepts, 3 of them to be precise. One of them was on the 4, what I'll call the 4 stages of identity, which is related to who am I and who are we aren't. You know, it's saying here we're not our body, mind, or emotions. We are divine souls on a wondrous journey. So all of this is getting back to that sentence in a long way. So went through the idea of 4 different identities that quite often we start out with an external ego identity, which is negative. Then we move to an external ego identity, which is positive. Then we move to an internal spiritual identity of being the soul, but separate from others. Then we move to the internal spiritual identity of being the core of the soul, in which case we're one with everyone and we are experiencing God. So I went through that explanation, starting out by explaining, you know, what it is to be an unworthy, feel like a negative external identity, feeling unworthy and so forth, and where that comes from. It comes from how we're raised primarily by our parents and how that's reinforced by our teachers. And if it's done a certain way, then we grow up and we have a very poor self-concept. We feel we're not worthy. We feel other people are smarter than we are. We've been told we're stupid a lot, and we believe it. You know, so if we end up with that baggage, which could be avoided if the parents and the teachers raised us differently, we have to throw it off. So afterwards, I'm told she talked to one of the monks and she really liked that. I went on at some length on that point, and she said even the children present, there were some around 10 or 12 years old, could relate to that point, and she was very happy it was being made, the whole idea of how to correct children in a positive way and how to avoid creating this sense of feeling unworthy, this negative external ego. Doesn't have to be there. We don't have to put it into children. But if we do, then we have to throw it off and move into the positive ego, feeling just as good as everyone else, maybe a little better if we've got some pride. But anyway, we're okay. Someone else has a problem. If there's a problem, it belongs to someone else, not to us. You know, we have a positive attitude about what we can accomplish, though it may be somewhat egotistical. And then that is necessary. In other words, we can't go from a negative attitude to feeling we're a divine being. Doesn't work. No way we're a divine being. We're worthless, this and that. I can tell you why. And all the things I did wrong, all the times my parents told me I was stupid. You know, we can't move from that consciousness of feeling badly about ourselves to feeling we're a divine being. We have to feel good about ourselves first. Once we do, then we have the chance of moving into this spiritual identity of being the soul, in terms of our Sanskrit terminology, atma darshana. We see ourselves as an individual soul, a pure spiritual being. And then taking that one step deeper is the paramatma darshana, going into the core of the soul and experiencing Satchitananda and Parashiva in our terminology, or omnipresence and transcendence, God's omnipresence and God's transcendence. But that's only half the story. It's a great philosophy. We can sit there and read the Upanishads and get inspired. Now, this is great. You know, man is not man, man is God, Atman is Brahman. You know, it can be pretty inspiring stuff to read that. But what's missing? We don't have the tools to make it a reality in our life, right? Well, how do we do this? How do we move from a negative self-concept to a positive self-concept? How do we move from a positive self-concept to a divine identity? How do we move from a divine identity to an identity with God? Well, that's why we've got the other book, Merging with Shiva, right? That's got more tools than we can ever use in one lifetime, and it gives us the how-to. So that's the beauty of Gurudeva's teachings. It gives the high philosophy, but it also gives us practical techniques that we can utilize in our daily life and transform our consciousness over time. In this case, move ourselves through these four stages of identity. And of course, and actually this was in one of the lessons recently too, just about the time I was mentioning it, two of the primary tools for this purpose are the Vasana Daha Tantra and affirmations. So through clearing the mind out of all the miscellaneous experiences that have happened to us, all the unresolved problems, all the negative situations, harmonizing ourselves with our parents, our teachers, other people, our brothers and sisters, where there wasn't harmony before, forgiving people we thought mistreated us and we had grudges against. Going through all of that, which is part of the Vasana Daha Tantra, clears out the subconscious. It's like taking out the trash. You know, we've got an empty can finally. And then we have to remold the subconscious through the power of affirmation. So we have those techniques as well to develop a sense of being a positive person, that we can accomplish things, and then to develop a sense of our divine identity. So those are just two of the major tools involved in that process. So all of that is just one sentence, right? We have the second sentence. We came from God, live in God, and are evolving into oneness with God. So Gurudeva elaborates on this in the Bhāṣya. Vedic rishis have given us courage by uttering the simple truth, God is the life of our life. And as we know in the Tamil language, that's uyirukuyir, right in my lexicon, two uyirs with a ka in the middle. Uyirukuyir, God is the life of our life. Sri Yogaswami carried it further by saying, there is one thing God cannot do. God cannot separate himself from us. This is because God is our life. God is the life in the birds. God is the life in the fish. God is the life in the animals. Becoming aware of this life energy in all that lives is becoming aware of God's loving presence within us. Each day we should try to see the life energy in trees, birds, animals, and people. I'd say, and especially people, myself. Commentary. So again, that's a wonderful philosophy, but unless we figure out a way to practice it, we don't necessarily live it or feel it. It's too high-minded. It doesn't really connect with the state of mind we're in. So Gurudeva gave us some simple guidelines for how to practice this, which was to look into the eyes of another person. Don't look at their feet, their hands. You look into their eyes. And if you look into their eyes deeply enough, you'll see God Shiva in there as the life of their life. And you'll see them as a divine being. So, of course, if we don't like the person, this can be hard to do. If we're mad at the person and are, you know, not talking to them today, this can be hard to do. You know, we have to get by any kind of external emotional relationship we thought we wanted to create with that person. We have to set that aside. We can't do it if we're going through those kinds of thoughts about another person. We have to just look deeply into their eyes, deeply enough to see God, by setting aside these concepts of likes and dislikes and emotional tangles with people. So it's a wonderful practice, and it's the essence of the idea of namaskaram. Namaskaram is more than just a cultural gesture at its deepest level, and it's explained beautifully in the lexicon I was looking at in Dancing with Shiva. It says, you know, by joining the left and the right hand, we balance the Idin Pingala forces, putting us into the Sushumna or spiritual consciousness in the spine, which allows us to see with our third eye deeply enough into the other individual to see their divinity. Oh, what a definition. I love our lexicon. It's really good. So that's the idea there. And the third sentence. We are in truth the truth we seek. Om. So what does that mean? We are in truth the truth we seek. Well, Gurudeva says it another way elsewhere. We are already that which we seek, which is even a little clearer, that we don't have to wait. We don't have to do something. At the deepest level, we are already Parashiva and Satchitananda. It's only the soul body that's in a state of becoming or maturing. But the rest is sitting there ready to claim anytime we want to claim it, as we've talked about. But that's in the future slokas. I don't want to use all that up today. I need that for the next talk. Slokas 3, 4, and 5. So that gets more into that. But this hints at it in a very nice way that we're already the truth. Very nice. Sloka number 2. Where am I going? What is my path? We are all growing toward God, and experience is the path. Through experience, we mature out of fear into fearlessness, out of anger into love, out of conflict into peace, out of darkness into light, and union in God. Om. So that's important, focuses on experience. And that was another point we made to Billy's group, that we could, how do we describe the Hindu concept of the spiritual path? And I gave three synonyms: becoming a better person, improving our behavior, learning from our experiences. You know, that's the simplest way I could think of to explain to this group the Hindu spiritual path. Becoming a better person and learning from our experiences and improving our behavior. So if we're not doing that, then we're not making the spiritual progress that we could. So the more we can do that, the more progress we're making. And the idea of learning from our experiences is particularly important. And as I mentioned in that talk, the biggest barrier in that regard is the concept that mistakes are bad, wrong, shouldn't happen. So rather than the concept that mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn. All we have to do is figure out what we need to learn. So when it says the path is experience, it means we realize that what we did, we could do better. We should do better. There's another way of doing things. We're refining our behavior. We're learning from our experiences. So that won't happen if we feel we shouldn't make mistakes. If we feel we shouldn't make mistakes, we make a mistake, we go into self-pity, sorrow, self-condemnation. That's our reaction. If we make a mistake and we feel we shouldn't make mistakes. Whereas, what we want to do is we make a mistake, we become self-reflective without emotion, and we say, gee, how can I avoid that in the future? I know the goal is to only make a mistake once. So two different ways of relating to mistakes. So how we look at mistakes is key to progressing through our experiences, not just reacting to them. So I thought I'd read from the Bossi also. It's so rich, it really can't summarize it. Gurudeva's Bhāṣya. We have taken birth in a physical body to grow and evolve into our divine potential. We are inwardly already one with God. There's the word already. Our religion contains the knowledge of how to realize this oneness and not create unwanted experiences along the way. So that's very useful. It's pointing out what we're talking about. Our religion contains the knowledge of how to realize this oneness. So those are the techniques in merging with Shiva, our sadhanas, our tantras, and through putting them into practice in our life, then we maximize our spiritual progress. Not create unwanted experiences along the way means to be careful in terms of the karmas we're creating by our current actions. That the knowledge, such as we summarized in karma management, which is just a systemized statement of Gurudeva's principles on karma, it's all drawn from the trilogy. When we understand the principles of karma management, there's no way we're going to create new negative karmas. We're smarter than that. No, we've got this figured out. We may have some real whoppers coming to us from the past, but at least we're not creating any for the future. You know, we've got that much figured out in terms of our karma. Continuing on, the peerless path is following the way of our spiritual forefathers, discovering the mystical meaning of the scriptures. The peerless path is commitment, study, discipline, practice, and the maturing of yoga into wisdom. So we're talking about the kinds of spiritual practices we need to follow and how we need to follow them. We need to be consistent, which here is the word commitment. Commitment means consistency also. So consistency in our practices is very important, and it's better to... There's more value in that which you can sustain. In other words, sometimes when we're youthful, we try and do too much. Try and set a level of sadhana. Of course, those who are older don't do this. Try and set a level of sadhana that's something we can't sustain. So eventually we have to back off. So what we can sustain is what's good to be sure to keep going on a daily basis, a weekly basis. In the beginning stages, we suffer until we learn. Learning leads us to service, and selfless service is the beginning of spiritual striving. This is a beautiful statement, really. Suffer, learn, service, understanding, meditation. So, if we're suffering, it means we're not doing something right. We're not supposed to suffer. No. Guru Deva didn't like suffering. He said, life is meant to be lived joyously. So, if we're suffering, it means we don't understand something about the spiritual path. Or maybe we're going through some rough karma. That could be one reason for suffering. But the idea of suffering here doesn't mean going through some rough karma from the past. It means doing unwise actions in the present, which are bringing back suffering. That's what it's referring to. Not managing our karma. So we suffer until we start to manage our karma, act in ways that doesn't create new karma for us of a negative nature, which is what learning means. We suffer until we learn. Learn what? How to not create new negative karma. So, said another way, we're creating suffering for ourselves in the future every time we create negative karma in the present. So when we figure out, when we learn enough about karma and learn and gain enough self-control, then we stop creating new negative karma for the future, which is moving from suffering to learning. Learning leads us to service. So service is the sense of not being totally selfish. We're concerned about others. We're concerned about the temple. We're concerned about this. We're concerned about that. And we spend time to do things which benefits other people, benefits the temple, and so forth. It doesn't give us any immediate gratification in an external sense. It gives us a spiritual gratification, of course. So service is a natural state of consciousness we come into when our karma is going along smoothly. Service leads us to understanding. Understanding in this case means religious understanding of the temple, understanding of the states of mind, that kind of understanding. Understanding leads us to meditate deeply and without distractions. That's self-explanatory. Finally, meditation leads us to surrendering God. This is the straight and certain path, the sanmarga, leading to self-realization, the inmost purpose of life, and subsequently to moksha, freedom from rebirth. The Vedas wisely affirm, and this is such a perfect quote from the Vedas, to illustrate this. By austerity, goodness is obtained. From goodness, understanding is reached. From understanding, the self is obtained. And he who obtains the self is freed from the cycle of birth and death. Om Namah Shivaya. Thank you.
I want to welcome all our guests this morning. Vanakkam, Namaste. I want to congratulate Saroja Devi for being so well behaved, the star of the show. This is a wonderful week. We're leading up to our worship of Shiva on Mahashivaratri, very important and powerful festival. So this morning I was thinking about God Shiva in anticipation of Shivaratri. And we're also working on an article for Hinduism Today on a similar subject, on the nature of God. Nature of God. And one of the misconceptions, and sometimes we have visitors come here. We've had, two ladies come here. A couple of years ago, one was a Hindu, one was a non-Hindu, and came into the temple, and the Hindu lady was explaining Shiva to the non-Hindu lady and said, well, yes, Shiva's the destroyer, so we're worshipping the destroyer. And so that's what we're trying to destroy with this article in Hinduism Today. Destroy the concept that Shiva's the destroyer. So, of course, that's not how it's looked at. That's not a correct understanding. But somehow it's a popular understanding, perpetuated in many books in different ways. And so, of course, Shiva is the supreme being to Saivites. And the supreme being does destroy, but he also creates and preserves. So to call Shiva the destroyer is missing the mark. It's very misleading, because in the worship, that's not how we're looking at it. We're looking at it that Shiva is the supreme being. He creates, preserves, and destroys the universe, creates, preserves, and absorbs back the soul. So looking at him as destroyer is something not particularly good. And in addition to the three actions, creation, preservation, and destruction, of course he has two other actions. One's called concealing grace, and the other is the revealing grace. Concealing grace is the idea that Shiva pervades everything. He's inside of us. He's inside the temple. He's inside of everything, inside the tree. He pervades everything. But yet we can't see him. How is this? It's his concealing grace. He's hidden himself. Shiva pervades everything. He's all pervasive. But we can't even see him. So, when through grace we do see him, that's called his revealing grace. He shows himself to us. We become aware of Shiva inside of us. That which was hidden is seen. So those two actions of grace are also very important when it comes to understanding God Shiva. Because, of course, on Shivaratri, we want to see him to some degree or another. We're definitely wanting him to reveal himself. And the five actions of Shiva are also in the five names that are found in the Agamic worship, Ishana, Taparusha, Gauravamadeva, Sadyojata, as we all know. It's Yogi Mahadevan was chanting this morning. The five names, one for each of the five actions, shows the Agamic perspective that Shiva is Supreme Being and performs these five actions.